Before we jump in, a quick shout out to our sponsor. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's a seriously great resource if you're prepping for the exam.
Definitely. So, you know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this inherent expectation of precision.
Right, like it feels almost like engineering.
Exactly. You fall off your bike, you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line on the screen, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is.
Broken or not broken. Very clean.
Yeah, it's binary. And we like things to be categorized with absolute certainty because, honestly, it's comforting.
Oh, absolutely.
But then you step into the world of regulatory compliance and broker-dealer operations, and suddenly it feels like that x-ray machine is just completely busted.
Completely broken.
We aren't looking at neat, jagged little lines on a screen anymore. We're looking at a massive, shifting landscape of human behavior, intent, complex corporate delegation, and it can get incredibly murky.
I mean, it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. If you don't know exactly what you are looking for, if you don't understand the underlying architecture of why these rules exist, you're just staring at a blur.
Right.
In the medical world, the biology is fixed. But in the regulatory world, the rules are constantly trying to wrap their arms around human ingenuity. And human ingenuity is, well, it's always trying to find a loophole.
Which is exactly what we are here to clear up today. So welcome to the deep dive. If you're listening to this, you're likely staring down the barrel of the Series 82 exam.
And you might be feeling a little overwhelmed by the sheer volume of regulations.
Oh, for sure. Today's mission is to dismantle Function 2, which is supervisory approvals for accounts.
This section alone is worth a solid 18% of your exam, which is huge.
Yeah, that translates to 9 scored items that can absolutely make or break your pass rate.
It's a massive chunk of the test, and understandably so. I mean, this entire function is focused on the guardrails.
The guardrails, right.
Yeah, the principal level reviews, the sign-offs, the firm level validations. It's the structural engineering that keeps a broker-dealer from collapsing into total chaos.
Or worse, becoming like an accidental vehicle for money laundering and fraud.
Exactly.
And because you need this information to stick in your brain for exam day, especially if you're someone who glazes over when reading dry textbook jargon, we are setting some ground rules right now.
Love it. Let's hear them.
There will be no dry textbook reading today. Zero.
Thank goodness.
Instead, we're going to use absurd, memorable scenarios. We are going to prompt you to pause and really think through the mechanics of the rules.
Because context is everything, right?
Right. And we're going to use a recurring cast of characters to bring these FINRA regulations to life.
Yeah, when you attach a dry, seemingly arbitrary rule to a vivid, real-world story, your brain actually stops trying to just memorize it.
It starts actually understanding it. You start to see the regulatory logic.
Exactly.
So let's introduce this cast of characters you're going to be spending the next hour or so with. First, we have Riley the Rep.
Ah, Riley.
Yeah, Riley is a registered representative. He's eager. He wears cheap suits that make him sweat a lot. He's heavily motivated by his commission payouts. And because he just loves closing a deal, he's highly prone to corner cutting.
Every single compliance department in the country has a Riley.
Oh, guaranteed.
I mean, they're the engine of the firm's revenue, but they're also the primary source of the firm's heartburn.
For sure. Next, we have his absolute favorite client, Ingrid the Investor.
Okay, tell us about Ingrid.
Ingrid is eccentric.
Yeah.
She is highly mobile-like. She's always traveling, changing addresses, changing her mind. She is incredibly wealthy, and she makes these weird, spontaneous demands on Riley's time.
So she's a compliance officer's worst nightmare, basically.
100%. But a sales rep's dream client.
Right. High net worth, high activity, but very high risk.
Yep. And finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam operates in the private placement and alternative investment space.
Sounds fancy.
Well, Sam loves moving money around in, let's just say, mysterious ways. He runs a lot of cash-heavy businesses, laundromats, car washes, vending machines, and he frequently deals in physical currency.
Gotcha.
So, keeping Riley, Ingrid, and Sam in your mind, let's establish the core theme of this entire unit. Why does Function 2 even exist in the first place?
So, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the fundamental why of this entire unit comes down to one absolute truth.
Okay, what is it?
And you must internalize this for the exam. A representative like our guy, Riley, never, ever has unilateral authority to open or change a customer account.
Wait, never. So Riley can't just schmooze Ingrid, get her to sign a paper, click a button in the firm software, and make her a client?
Never. The firm itself, acting through its designated principles and its written procedures, is the ultimate gatekeeper. Yeah, I mean, Riley is out there in the field, gathering the assets, pitching the business, doing all the legwork. But the firm is the fortress.
The fortress.
Right. Firm decides if those assets are allowed inside the walls and under what conditions. Riley simply does not have the keys to the gate.
I really love that visual. Riley is just knocking on the door with Ingrid standing behind him, and the principal has to actually turn the deadbolt and let them in.
That's exactly it.
So let's start right at the foundation of that fortress. We are talking about supervisory systems and control testing.
Right.
Okay, let's unpack this. Who is actually in charge here? Because when we read FINRA rules, we constantly see the phrase the firm and then the phrase the principal.
Yeah, they pop up everywhere.
So what is the actual legal difference between those two entities in the eyes of the regulator? Because, you know, to a layman, they sound like the exact same thing.
And this is a crucial distinction that trips up a lot of test takers.
Oh, I bet.
A member firm, which is the broker-dealer as a corporate entity, must build what is called a supervisory system.
Mm-hmm.
And this system must be reasonably designed to achieve compliance with applicable securities, laws, regulations, and FINRA rules.
See, the phrase reasonably designed always catches my ear. It implies that FINRA isn't demanding a perfect, flawless system that catches 100% of errors.
Right, because that's impossible.
Yeah, they're demanding a system that is logical and structurally sound.
That is a vital nuance.
Hmm.
The firm can't just operate on good vibes, you know, hoping its reps are ethical.
Right, crossing their fingers.
It needs documented, logical processes. Now, the firm is an abstract corporate entity. It can't actually read an email or physically sign a document.
Sure.
So the firm designates an appropriately registered principal, a human being,
yeah,
to carry out the day-to-day supervisory responsibilities.
But, and this is where the exam tries to get you, if the human principal is the one doing the work, who holds the ultimate legal bag if something goes catastrophically wrong?
The final responsibility for proper supervision always rests with the firm itself. The member firm owns the result.
Okay, so put yourself in the listener's shoes for a second. You get a scenario on the exam.
Let's hear it.
Riley, the rep, executes a totally unsuitable, unauthorized trade for Ingrid. The designated branch manager, the principal, was supposed to review Riley's trades, but he was busy, you know, playing golf and just rubber stamped it.
Classic.
FNIRA comes in and investigates. And the exam question asks, who holds final responsibility for this failure?
Right.
The instinct is to point at the lazy branch manager. He failed his duty. But you're saying the answer is the firm.
The answer is the firm. The designated principal failed to carry out the supervision, and they will absolutely face individual sanctions or fines.
Oh, for sure they're in trouble.
But the ultimate ownership of that failure, the final responsibility for the supervisory system breaking down, rests with the member firm itself.
Wow.
Think of it like a car manufacturer. If the driver crashes because the brakes fail, the driver might be at fault for not swerving, but the manufacturer is ultimately responsible for putting a defective car on the road.
The firm is the manufacturer. That completely shifts how you have to read these questions.
Exactly.
Okay, so how does the firm actually document this system? Because a system is just a concept. How does a regulator audit a concept?
They audit the manual. This brings us to WSPs, or written supervisory procedures. These are the physical, or let's be real, more likely today, digital manuals that the firm establishes, maintains, and enforces.
Right, to supervise its business and its people.
Exactly. And just like the overarching system, these WSPs must be reasonably designed to achieve compliance.
So if the supervisory system is the restaurant concept, say a high-end French bistro, the WSPs are the actual recipe book.
I like where this is going.
Like step one, julienne the carrots. Step two, sear the steak. Step three, verify the client's identity.
That is a perfect nail-right. But WSPs tell the employees exactly how to execute the firm's compliance philosophy on a daily basis.
But having a beautifully bound recipe book doesn't mean the food actually tastes good.
Very true.
Or that the chicken is cooked all the way through and won't give everyone salmonella.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Which brings us to the concept of control testing.
Yes.
If the WSPs are the recipe, control testing is forcing the head chef to sit down at a table in the dining room once a year, order off their own menu, and eat the food to prove it actually works in practice.
I really like that framing. Because writing the procedures and testing the procedures are treated as two completely separate regulatory duties.
Okay, two separate duties.
Yeah, it goes back to human nature. The person who wrote the rule usually assumes the rule works. You need a dedicated process to actively try and break the rule to see if it holds up.
Okay, let's test that out for the listener. Think about the scenario for a second. If a firm hires the most expensive compliance consultants in the world and they write the absolute best, most comprehensive written supervisory procedures in the history of Wall Street, are they done with their regulatory duty?
Give them a second to think.
Nope. Writing the manual is duty number one. Testing whether that manual actually functions in the real world when Riley is trying to push the boundaries is a totally separate duty.
Yep. The rules mandate that the firm must designate one or more principals to establish, maintain, and enforce a system of supervisory control policies.
Got it.
And these policies test and verify that the WSPs are actually reasonably designed.
And crucially, this testing isn't just an academic exercise, right?
Not at all. The testing must mandate the creation or amendment of procedures where the tests show that something is broken, missing, or inadequate.
So you can't just run the test, find a massive loophole where Riley is secretly texting clients on an unapproved app and say, well, the test was successful. We found a hole. Good job, everyone. See you next year.
No, definitely not.
You have to actually rewrite the recipe to fix the hole.
Exactly. The feedback loop must be closed. And when it comes to designating these specific control principals, the people running these tests, there's a very specific exam detail you need to flag.
Ooh, let's hear it.
The firm must specifically identify these designated control principals to FINRA.
Operationally, what does that mean? Do they call up a regulator in Washington and say, hey, just letting you know, Susan from the third floor is doing our control testing this year?
I mean, in practice, it happens through FINRA's digital registration and contact systems. The firm updates its records to tag Susan as a designated control principal.
Right.
But for the exam, you don't need to know the software interface. You need to know the rule's exact phrasing.
Okay.
The firm must specifically identify them to FINRA. If a multiple choice question asks how a firm handles the assignment of its control principals, look for the answer that uses that specific phrase.
Okay, so Susan, the control principal, runs the test. She finds out the soup is too salty, meaning the WSPs have a gap, and she amends the procedures to fix it.
Right.
How does the executive suite find out that the firm was operating with a gap in its armor?
So the designated principal, Susan, in this case, must submit a formal report to the firm's senior management at least annually.
At least annually, so they could do it quarterly, but once a year is the hard floor.
Exactly.
What actually goes into this annual report? Because I know the exam loves to test lists of requirements. Test takers love to memorize the three things or the five things.
And that is a very dangerous habit for this specific rule.
Really? Why?
While the required contents act like a list, the actual text of the FINRA rule doesn't number the items. It's written organically as one long flowing requirement.
Oh, I see.
My strong advice to test takers, learn the conceptual contents of the report, but do not memorize a specific numerical count.
That makes sense.
Yeah, the exam writers might group the concepts into two bullet points, or they might stretch them into four. If you're looking for the three things, you might totally psych yourself out.
That's a great tip. So conceptually, what are the core elements that must be in that annual memo to the C-suite?
First, the report must detail the firm's system of supervisory controls. It has to explain how they are testing the firm. Second, it must include a summary of the test results and any significant identified exceptions.
Meaning the times the firm failed its own tests.
Exactly. And finally, it must detail any new procedures that were created or amended in response to those failures.
Okay, so the system used, a summary of the failures, and the fixes applied. It's essentially a comprehensive diagnostic report of the firm's regulatory immune system.
That's a great way to summarize it. And again, if you see a question about this annual testing and reporting to senior management, recognize that it is testing your knowledge of control testing, not just the underlying supervisory system itself.
Right.
The system is the baseline infrastructure. The control testing is the active annual stress test of that infrastructure.
Beautiful. So we have our blueprint, we have our recipe book, and we have our food critics stressing the menu.
Right.
Now let's talk about the mechanics of actually letting people into the restaurant.
Let's do it.
Let's move to principal approval and refusal of new accounts.
Okay, the front door.
Right, the front door. Let's bring in our cast. Riley the rep has just spent 3 grueling hours schmoozing Ingrid the investor at a ridiculously expensive steakhouse.
As he does.
Exactly. He has pitched her on the firm's track record. He's gathered all her financial data, her risk tolerance, her net worth, and she finally agrees to open a brokerage account.
Great news for Riley.
Huge. So Riley opens his laptop at the table, fills in all the fields in the firm's portal, and hits submit.
Okay.
Now, take a second to ask yourself. The moment Riley hits submit, does that account open? Is Ingrid officially a client?
Think about it.
The answer is absolutely not.
Not a chance. An account cannot open without a principal's documented approval. The rules explicitly state that the account record must carry the signature of a partner, officer, or manager, meaning a registered principal, denoting that the account has been accepted in accordance with the firm's policies and procedures.
So Riley's signature, or Riley's digital submission, means absolutely nothing for the actual opening of the account.
It proves he solicited the business, and it proves he gathered the initial data. But it has zero regulatory power to accept the account on behalf of the firm.
Wow.
A representative can never approve the account they opened.
Let's dig into the why here. Why is this rule so strict? I mean, why can't Riley just open it? He did all the work. He knows Ingrid better than anyone sitting in a home office cubicle hundreds of miles away.
This goes back to objective risk management. Think about the incentives.
Okay.
Riley is heavily motivated by the commission. He has a massive financial incentive to get Ingrid's money in the door as quickly as possible.
Right, he wants that payout.
And that intense incentive creates a massive blind spot, whether it's intentional or just subconscious bias.
Yeah.
Riley might overlook major red flags about her suitability, her true identity, or where her wealth actually came from.
So he might ignore the fact that her money seems sketchy just to get the deal done.
Exactly. The firm needs a named executive, a principal, who is removed from the immediate commission payout-taking formal documented responsibility that Ingrid meets the firm's compliance standards.
Got it.
The principal acts as the objective firewall between the sales motivation and the regulatory reality.
I love the idea of the principal as the firewall. So we need a principal's signature, and it has to be documented.
Always.
Which brings me to what I call the verbal thumbs-up fallacy.
Oh, this happens all the time.
Let's play out an absurd scenario to make this stick. Riley's back at the branch office. He is standing at the urinal in the men's room.
Oh, boy.
The designated principal steps up to the urinal right next to him. Riley looks over, which is obviously a violation of basic men's room etiquette right there, and says, "Hey, boss, I submitted Ingrid's account paperwork. Looks good, right? Suitable. Clean."
No, Riley, don't do it.
The principal, staring straight ahead at the tile wall, says, "Yeah, Riley, looks great. Go ahead and start trading."
We laugh, but versions of this happen every single day in offices.
A tale as old as time, the informal hallway approval.
Yeah.
Here is where the exam will try to lure you in. Let's say Ingrid's account is, in reality, perfectly suitable.
Okay.
It's clean, all the data is accurate, there are zero red flags, and she is the perfect client. Does that verbal sign-off from the principal at the urinal satisfy the FINRA supervisory requirement?
No. It satisfies absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
Even if the account is 100% suitable and pristine, an undocumented verbal sign-off is a serious rule violation.
Wow.
The principal review must be evidenced in writing, period.
Yeah.
If it is not in writing, it did not happen in the eyes of the regulator.
If it's not written down, it's just a rumor. The wet signature, or, you know, the verified digital equivalent, is the only thing that creates the legal reality of the account.
Exactly right.
Now, I want to explicitly compare this account opening rule to another rule that frequently trips people up, because the exam loves to mix up vocabulary words to test if you actually understand the distinct mechanisms.
Yes, this is a big one.
Let's compare account approval versus transaction review.
This is a vital comparison. Opening the account is one distinct, isolated supervisory duty. It is governed by that acceptance signature on the account record we just talked about.
Right. It happens once at the inception of the relationship.
Correct. However, there is a completely separate supervision rule that requires a registered principal to review in writing every transaction relating to the firm's investment banking or securities business.
So I have a signature requirement to give Ingrid the membership card to the club, and I have a separate written review requirement to monitor what drinks she is ordering once she's inside.
That is a great way to separate them. The supervision rule explicitly names the final acceptance of a new account and the review of customer orders as two entirely different functions.
Interesting.
Yeah, only the customer order function runs through the transaction review requirement.
So on exam day, if you see a question about opening an account, do not treat the opening process itself as a transaction.
Exactly. Do not conflate the vocabulary. Opening an account is not a transaction under this specific regulatory framework.
They're kept in separate silos.
Yep. Both require a registered principal, and both require written documentation. But they're separate regulatory duties with different procedural mechanics.
Okay, so that's how an account gets opened. How does an account get refused?
Good question.
Let's say Ingrid's paperwork is a mess, or the principal finds out her money comes from an illegal offshore casino. What is the formal mechanism for refusing the account? Is there a special refusal of business form that has to be filed with the SEC?
It's much simpler and more elegant than that.
Really?
Because the account record must carry that principal signature denoting acceptance in order to open. A principal who simply refuses to sign has, in effect, formally refused the account.
Oh, wow.
It cannot open without that documented approval. The authority to refuse sits in the exact same chair and relies on the exact same mechanism as the authority to approve. It's simply the withholding of the signature.
The power to approve is the power to deny.
Okay.
Easy.
Exactly.
But speaking of shady behavior, like illegal offshore casinos, let's dive into why a principal might refuse an account and what happens next.
This gets really interesting.
Yeah, shake out the paperwork from your brain for a second, because we are moving from administrative roles to straight up fraud prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about customer identification program failures, or CIP.
CIP is huge.
Let's go back to Riley bringing in Ingrid's paperwork. But this time, something is deeply off.
Okay.
He uploads her identification, and the passport she provided looks like it was printed on a home inkjet printer. The font is wrong. The laminate is peeling. I mean, it's giving Major McLovin from the movie Superbad energy.
The classic blatant red flag.
What happens if the firm simply cannot form a reasonable belief that they know Ingrid's true identity? The principal looks at this McLovin passport and says, absolutely not. This triggers the firm's customer identification program.
Yes. Under the Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering rules, the firm's CIP must include written procedures, specifically addressing situations where verification of a customer's identity fails.
Okay. Having these contingency procedures is mandatory.
What exactly do these procedures have to cover? Because what to do when things go wrong is a pretty broad mandate.
The rule mandates that the procedures should describe four specific operational outcomes.
Four outcomes. Got it.
Number one, the procedures must detail when the firm should not open the account at all.
Makes sense.
Number two, the terms under which a customer may transact while their verification is still pending.
Oh, pending. Okay.
Number three, when the firm should formally close the account after all verification attempts completely fail.
Right.
And number four, when the failure should lead the firm to file a suspicious activity report, or SAR.
Okay, let's pause and dissect this, because there is a lot of operational friction here.
There really is.
Take number two, transacting while verification is pending. If I'm a firm and I don't know who this person is yet, why on earth would I let them transact?
It's a reality of modern finance. Sometimes verification just takes time.
A client might wire in $1 million and want to buy treasury bills immediately to capture a yield, but their secondary identification check may be matching their foreign address to a utility bill. It's taking 48 hours.
Yeah, that happens.
The firm has to decide. Do we freeze the money and expose the client to market risk, potentially losing them as a customer if they get angry? Or do we let them buy the treasuries, but restrict them from wiring the money back out until the ID clears?
I see. So the pending state is a calculated risk. We might let you buy a stable asset so you don't lose yield, but we aren't letting you withdraw the funds to a third-party bank until we know you aren't a money launderer.
Precisely. The WSPs have to explicitly define what level of risk the firm is willing to take during that limbo period.
That makes total sense. Now, let me push back on the sequence of events here. Let's go back to the blatantly fake McLovin passport.
The fake passport.
If Ingrid hands us that obvious fake, we don't put her in a pending state. We just shred her paperwork. The principal refuses to sign the acceptance. We say no thanks, and we're done, right? We refuse the account, so the relationship never started. Therefore, we have no ongoing booty to her.
I am so glad you brought this up, because this logic is a massive trap on the exam.
Really? Why?
Refusing the account absolutely does not end the regulatory analysis. The firm still owes a duty to the broader financial system to decide if a suspicious activity report is required.
So even if she never actually becomes a customer, the mere attempt to open an account with fraudulent ID triggers the SAR analysis.
Exactly. The failed identity check isn't just a customer service decision about opening an account. It's a primary anti-money laundering trigger.
Oh, wow.
Think about it like airport security. If TSA finds a loaded weapon in your carry-on bag, they don't just deny you boarding, hand your bag back, and let you walk out the front doors of the airport to try again tomorrow.
Yeah, that would be insane.
Right. They refuse you entry to the plane, and they call the authorities.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. Refusing the account is denying boarding. Filing the SAR is calling the authorities.
Exactly.
So on exam day, if a scenario asks what a firm should do after refusing an account due to a failed ID check, do not pick the answer that implies the firm's obligations are complete and they can just walk away. You must look for the answer that mentions evaluating whether to file a SAR.
It is a dual obligation. Protect the firm by refusing the account and protect the system by filing the SAR.
Incredible. Okay, let's move forward in the timeline of an account.
What's it do?
Let's assume the McLovin passport was a misunderstanding. Ingrid provided a real, verified ID. She cleared CIP. The principal signed off. And her account is officially open. The money is deposited. The relationship has begun.
All good so far.
But clients aren't static. A year later, Ingrid decides she is tired of her penthouse in New York. She is moving to a mega yacht in international waters.
As one does.
Right. And because she is feeling adventurous on the high seas, she wants to change her investment objective from boring capital preservation to ultra-risky offshore derivatives.
Yeah.
So she emails Riley. Riley logs into the system, updates her address to the ocean, and changes her objective to max risk. He submits the change.
Okay.
Does this just happen automatically? Is it self-executing because a licensed rep pushed the button?
Not at all. Just like opening the account, account information changes are not self-executing.
So Riley can't just ninja this into the system?
No. The firm's WSPs must robustly cover changes made to customer account information after the account is opened. That explicitly includes address changes and investment objective changes.
The firm has to review it.
The firm must review it, but it goes a critical step further.
Mm.
The firm must validate those changes.
Validate them? How?
A documented customer confirmation, notification, or follow-up step is required for each processed account information change before the firm can actually rely on that new information to execute trades or send statements.
Okay, I am putting a massive exam trap flag right here.
Good call.
Listen to the specific vocabulary the rule uses. The exam will try to trick you into thinking that confirmation is the only valid route. They will paint a scenario where the firm must receive a signed, notarized letter back from Ingrid confirming she moved to a yacht.
Yes. They play on the natural assumption that a two-way confirmation is the safest and therefore the only regulatory option.
But that's not true. The rule gives you three alternative routes. Listen carefully to the options. Confirmation, notification, or follow-up. Any of the three works as long as it is a documented method.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the operational reality of why they offer three options. If you mail a client a letter asking them to confirm their new address, what do they usually do with it?
They throw it in the trash.
Yeah.
Clients notoriously ignore compliance mail.
They really do.
If the rule strictly required a two-way confirmation, the entire financial system would grind to a halt because clients simply don't reply. By allowing notification as an alternative, the firm can send a notice to Ingrid's original New York penthouse address saying, "We have processed a change of address to a yacht. If this was not you, call us immediately."
Oh, that makes sense.
If the firm documents that they sent that notification and they don't hear back, that satisfies the requirement.
That is such a vital operational nuance. So on exam day, if an answer choice says the firm must obtain customer confirmation, recognize that is likely too restrictive if another choice accurately reflects the confirmation, notification, or follow-up trio.
Spot on.
Now, I want to ask about the pairing of these two specific changes. Address changes and investment objective changes. Why does the rule lump them together? Changing your risk profile to maximum danger seems way more financially impactful than just changing your zip code.
Intuitively, changing risk seems like the bigger deal. But from a fraud prevention standpoint, an address change is actually the primary vector for account takeover fraud. If a hacker or a fraudster gains access to Ingrid's account, they don't just steal the money on day one. The first thing they do is change the mailing address and the email address on file.
Oh, I see.
They route all the account statements and trade confirmations to their own PO box.
Sneaky.
Once they control the communication flow, Then they change the investment objective, liquidate the safe assets, and wire the money out. Because they changed the address first, Ingrid never sees the notifications that her money is being moved.
Wow. So the address change is the canary in the coal mine. It's the prerequisite for the theft.
Exactly. That is why the regulatory framework treats an address change with the exact same severity and requires the exact same validation protocols as a change in investment objective.
That is fascinating.
So for this specific rule, treat them identically on exam day. The supervisory procedures must cover both, and both require that firm review and validation step down, the confirmation, notification, or follow-up before the firm relies on them.
Got it. Address change, objective change, same exact validation process. Okay, we've opened the account. We've managed the changes. Let's pivot to the end of the life cycle. Let's talk about closing accounts.
The back door.
The back door. We know how incredibly hard it is to open an account. It requires objective risk management, CIP verification, and a designated principal's physical documented signature.
Very strict.
So think through this logically. If it takes a principal's physical signature to open an account, whose exact signature does it take to formally close it?
This is a fantastic curveball that catches a lot of people off guard.
Give it a beat. Okay, what's the answer?
The answer is the FANARE rules do not mandate a specific principal's signature to close an account.
Wait, really? FANARE just doesn't care how it ends.
It's not that they don't care. It's that nothing in the standardized rules assigns closing authority the way it strictly assigns opening authority.
Why the asymmetry? I mean, why lock the front door with three deadbolts but leave the back door completely up to the firm?
It all comes back to regulatory risk exposure. Opening an account exposes the broker-dealer to brand new risks. Suitability risk, money laundering risk, margin exposure, reputational risk. The regulator wants to tightly control how you take on risk.
That makes sense.
Closing an account does the exact opposite. It removes regulatory risk from the firm's books. It severs the relationship. If a client is toxic or unprofitable or acting suspicious, the regulator wants the firm to be able to fire that client efficiently. Therefore, the regulators allow a firm to decide how an existing account relationship ends under its own written supervisory procedures.
So a firm could write a WSP that says, any registered rep can close an account upon client request, and that would be perfectly legal.
As long as it is documented in their reasonably designed WSPs, yes.
Okay, let me make sure I have this straight for the exam. Opening an account equals a strict universal FINRA rule requiring a principal signature.
Correct.
Closing an account equals looking at the firm's specific WSPs to see who they decided has the authority.
Exactly right. Do not carry the strict opening rule over to the closing scenario. If a test question asks who has the authority to close an account, look for the answer that defers to the firm's own written procedures rather than a named universal decision maker.
That asymmetry is just fascinating. All right, let's move into the day-to-day surveillance of the firm. We are talking about the review of correspondence and activity.
Okay, time to snoop.
Yeah, time to snoop. Riley is out there hustling. He is sending thousands of emails. He's texting clients on approved messaging platforms. He's mailing physical pitch decks. What kind of communications is the firm actually legally required to read? What is the scope of the snooping?
The firm's WSPs must provide for principal review of both incoming and outgoing correspondence.
Okay.
That includes electronic correspondence like emails and approved messaging apps. And crucially, it also includes internal communications relating to the firm's investment banking or securities business.
So they are reading Riley's emails to Ingrid. They are reading Ingrid's replies to Riley, and they are reading Riley's internal emails to his branch manager complaining about his payout grid.
If the internal email relates to the securities business, yes, it falls under the review scope.
Wow. Okay.
Now, there is a very specific regulatory standard applied to this review process. These review procedures must be appropriate for the firm's business, its size, its structure, and its customers.
Oh, stop right there. I hear alarm bells.
As you should. This is a massive vocabulary trap.
Let's unpack the phrase appropriate for the firm's business, its size, its structure, and its customers. Where does that exact standard apply?
It applies only to the correspondence review procedures.
It does not apply to the firm's written supervisory procedures generally.
Correct. Remember our discussion earlier. The general written supervisory procedures are held to the standard of being reasonably designed to achieve compliance. The appropriate for size and structure standard is a distinct, separate, lower level standard that belongs specifically to how a firm reviews emails and letters.
Why do they get a different standard?
Because reviewing communications is highly dependent on scale. If you have a two-person boutique firm, the principal might literally read every single email the other guy sends.
That makes sense.
That is appropriate for their size. If you are Merrill Lynch with thousands of reps sending millions of emails a day, human review of everything is impossible. An AI-driven lexicon search that flags keywords is appropriate for their structure. The rule allows the firm to scale their surveillance to match their reality.
But the trap is applying that scale argument to the whole system. That is such a sneaky exam writer trick. The question will ask, which of the following must be appropriate for the firm's size and structure? And they will put the firm's entire supervisory system as choice A.
And if you pick choice A, you lose the point. The overarching system must be reasonably designed. Only the correspondence review is judged on being appropriate for size and structure.
Okay, duly noted. Let's talk about the mechanics of who is actually doing all this reading.
Sure.
Let's say Riley's branch is growing fast. The designated principal is completely overwhelmed with the volume of correspondence. So the principal hires a bright college intern.
Okay, an intern.
The intern is unregistered. They haven't taken any Finanor exams. The principal sets the intern up at a desk and delegates the first pass reading of all incoming emails to the intern. The intern is told to flag anything that looks like a complaint.
Right.
Is this legal? Can an unregistered person read customer correspondence for compliance purposes?
What's fascinating here is that, yes, it actually is allowed. A principal may delegate certain functions of the correspondence review to people who are not registered.
I always assumed you had to have a license to touch anything compliance related.
You can delegate the physical act of reading. They can perform the delegated task.
Right.
But, and this is the core philosophy of delegation in the securities industry, delegating a task does not delegate the duty.
Ah, you can delegate the work, but you can't delegate the blame.
Exactly. The principal stays ultimately responsible for every necessary supervisory review. The principal must take reasonable and appropriate action to see that the delegated function is properly carried out. They have to train the intern, audit the intern's work, and oversee the process.
That makes sense.
If that unregistered intern misses an email where Ingrid explicitly complains that Riley stole money from her, Finneron does not sanction the intern. The intern has no license to revoke. Finneron sanctions the principal for failing to supervise.
So delegation is a tool, not a shield.
Precisely.
Okay, so what must be reviewed? Are there certain topics in these emails that they absolutely cannot skip or filter out?
Yes, there are strict non-negotiables. The required review specifically extends to correspondence and communications that reflect customer complaints, customer instructions, and anything involving customer funds and securities.
Complaints, instructions, funds, securities. Got it. But even with an intern helping, does the firm really have to read every single email Riley sends? What if he sends an email wishing Ingrid a happy birthday or inviting her to a golf tournament?
No, they don't have to read the birthday emails. For both transactions and correspondence, a firm is permitted to use a reasonably designed, risk-based review system.
Risk-based, meaning they focus the surveillance on the danger stuff.
Exactly. They don't have to read everything, provided they focus their resources on the areas posing the greatest numbers and risks of violation.
Like using algorithms.
Right. They use algorithms to scan for words like guarantee, promissory note, or angry.
Okay, but what about the rest?
For the correspondence that isn't reviewed before use, the routine daily emails, the firm must instead provide upfront education and training to the reps, document that training, and run random sampling and follow up.
So we train Riley on what he can and cannot say, we have him sign a paper saying he understands, and then we randomly sample his emails based on risk algorithms to make sure he isn't lying.
Precisely. Do not assume the review requirement means a principal must individually read every single piece of correspondence from beginning to end.
Okay, but when they do pull an email for review, what actually counts as a review?
Good question.
Think about what happens when you are clearing out your inbox. Riley's principal is doing his risk-based review. He clicks open an email from Ingrid. He glances at it, sees it's just a recipe for banana bread she sent to Riley, and he closes it.
Delicious, but irrelevant.
Right. Does that split-second open and close count as a documented regulatory review?
No, it does not. Yeah. Simply opening or accessing a communication on a screen, without more, is not a review in the eyes of Finneron. The documentation requirements to prove a review occurred are very strict.
What actually has to be logged in the system's record?
The record must capture 3 unconditional data points and 1 conditional data point.
Okay, what are the unconditional ones?
Unconditionally, it must identify the name of the reviewer, it must identify the specific item reviewed, and it must stamp the date of the review.
Name, item, date, every single time.
Right. And then it must also show the actions the firm took as a result of any significant regulatory issues the review identified.
Okay, here's another massive trap. The action taken entry is conditional.
Highly conditional. And test writers know people assume every log needs an action.
Because if the principal reads the banana bread email, there is obviously no significant regulatory issue, so there is no action taken to record.
Exactly.
You don't log action taken baked bread, you just record your name, the email, and the date, and you move on.
Right. The operational drag of having to log an action taken for every clean email would be catastrophic for a firm.
Mm.
The action taken entry is tied specifically to finding a problem.
Right.
If it's a clean review, there is no action to record. An exam answer saying that every review record must show an action taken is fundamentally wrong.
Don't fall for it. Only log the action if there is a fire to put out.
Yep.
All right, let's pivot. We spent a lot of time on digital chatter and emails. Let's talk about physical assets. Show me the money. We are moving into safeguarding cash and securities.
Let's get physical.
Let's talk about transmittals of money. Moving funds from a customer to a third party, or a customer to an outside entity, or moving funds to non-primary locations like PO boxes, and crucially, transmittals between customers and reps.
This is a big area for fraud.
Let's do a ridiculous scenario to highlight how broad this rule is.
Okay, hit me.
Riley is meeting Ingrid for an account review, but because Ingrid is eccentric, she insists they meet at a taco truck downtown.
Sounds messy.
Yeah, they are standing on the sidewalk eating El Pastor tacos. Ingrid pulls a folded-up paper check out of her designer purse, hands it across the salsa bar to Riley, and says, put this 50 grand in my account.
With salsa on it.
Probably. Does this physical handoff trigger any special regulatory rules, or is this just excellent high-touch customer service?
It might be good service, but it is highly regulated.
Yeah.
That scenario is a named controlled transmittal.
Oh.
The physical hand delivery of a check between a customer and a registered representative triggers the firm's documented validation requirement the exact same way a massive multi-million dollar digital wire transfer would.
Hey, really? A folded paper check handed over at a taco truck requires the same supervisory validation as a wire.
Yes. Think about the chain of custody. The moment Riley takes possession of that check, the firm has taken possession of the client's assets. But there is no immediate digital footprint of the transaction.
Ah, I see.
The firm's procedures must explicitly cover transmittals of funds between customers and reps. And just like the account changes we discussed earlier, a documented method of customer confirmation, notification, or follow-up is required for each such transmittal.
So the firm has to follow up with Ingrid, separate from Riley, and send a notice saying, hey, we confirm Riley took your $50,000 check at the taco truck on Tuesday.
Exactly. It prevents Riley from pocketing the check, forging an endorsement, and Ingrid thinking it was safely deposited into her brokerage account. The firm has to close the loop directly with the client.
That makes total sense. Chain of custody is everything. Now let's talk about the money itself. The rule uses a very specific phrase, monetary instruments.
Yes, very specific.
When most people hear that, they just think of cash. But cash isn't just paper bills with dead presidents on them, right?
Right. The term monetary instrument actually comes from the Bank Secrecy Act, or BSA. It's the technical legal term behind the phrase cash equivalents.
Okay.
A monetary instrument functions as close to raw, untraceable currency as a paper instrument possibly can. Because of that liquidity and anonymity, the firm's safeguarding duties apply to these items just as strictly as they apply to a stack of $100 bills.
What exactly counts as a monetary instrument under the BSA?
Currency, obviously.
Yeah.
Coin and paper money from any country. Traveler's checks in any form. And then we get to the dangerous stuff. Negotiable instruments that are transferable by delivery.
Transferable by delivery. Let's translate that out of legalese. That's a fancy way of saying bearer form, right? Like a bearer bond.
Yes. When a check, a promissory note, or a money order is in bearer form, or if it has been endorsed without restriction, it means whoever physically holds the piece of paper legally owns the money.
Just by holding it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ownership passes simply by handing it to someone else. There is no named payee required to cash it.
Okay. Exam trap flag right here. Let's bring Sam, the sponsor, back in.
Okay, Sam.
Sam walks into the branch office with a cashier's check for $50,000. But he hasn't filled in the pay to the order of line yet. The pay name is completely blank.
Anger.
If I'm a teller, I might look at that and think, it's a cashier's check, it's drawn on a bank, it's safe.
That is a fatal operational error. Because the pay line is blank, it is an incomplete instrument. and because it is incomplete, it essentially functions as bearer paper.
Ah, I see.
If Sam drops that blank cashier's check on the sidewalk, whoever picks it up can write their own name on the line and cash it.
So it's basically cash.
Right. Therefore, it is grouped with currency. It is a monetary instrument. It absolutely does not get the lighter standard handling a firm would give an ordinary personal check that is made out specifically to the broker-dealer.
So if the paper can be spent by whoever picks it up off the sidewalk, it's a monetary instrument and must be locked down and safeguarded exactly like raw cash.
Exactly. Now, there are limits to this definition, and the exam might test the boundaries.
What are the limits?
The rules specifically note that monetary instruments do not include warehouse receipts or bills of lading.
So if Sam, the sponsor, brings in a warehouse receipt proving he owns 10,000 pounds of physical copper sitting in a storage facility in Nevada, that is not a monetary instrument.
Correct. It obviously has significant financial value, but it is not highly liquid, it is not easily transferable as currency, and it is not treated as a cash equivalent under the Bank Secrecy Act for these specific safeguarding rules.
Okay, let's move from cash to securities. Stock certificate.
Right.
The firm has a regulatory duty for possession and control. Broker-dealers must promptly obtain physical possession or control of all fully paid securities.
True.
But I want to push back on this, because the real world is messy. What if the mail is just slow? Or the DTCC, the clearing firm, is lagging on their end?
It happened.
What if Riley mailed physical stock certificates to the home office via certified mail, and the post office routed them to the wrong state and lost them for a week? Is the firm instantly violating the possession and control rule? Are they getting fined because the post office made a mistake?
No, the regulators are aware that the physical world has friction, a temporary lag between when a security is theoretically required to be in the firm's possession and when it actually gets there does not automatically violate the duty.
Okay, phew. So there is some grace.
But there are incredibly strict conditions to that grace. The delay is only excused if the lag results solely from normal business operations.
Meaning, the post office routing a package through the wrong sorting facility is a normal business friction. But Riley leaving the certificates in the trunk of his car for 3 weeks while he goes on a golf vacation to Florida is not normal business friction.
Exactly. And the firm must take timely, good faith steps to establish possession once they realize there is a delay. They have to call the post office, track the package, and document their efforts.
Here is a massive nuance for the exam. Who has the burden of proof here? If FINRA audits the firm and sees a 3-week lag in obtaining possession of a stock certificate, does FINRA have to prove that Riley was negligent?
No. The burden of proof sits entirely, 100%, with the broker dealer. A firm cannot simply shrug and assert to regulators, hey, the delay was normal.
So they have to prove it.
Yes. The firm must affirmatively show and prove that the delay was solely the result of normal business operations and that it acted promptly and in good faith to fix it. If they have no documentation tracking the lost mail, they lose the argument by default.
Guilty until proven normal. I like it. It forces the firm to be proactive.
Exactly.
Now, what if things go really maliciously wrong? What if Riley actually steals Ingrid's money? He takes that check from the taco truck, forges her signature, and cashes it himself. This is called improper use, right?
Yes, the rule is blunt. No person associated with a member may make improper use of a customer's securities or funds. It is a standalone, absolute prohibition.
But wait, let's tie this back to the very beginning of the deep dive. We said the firm built a reasonably designed supervisory system, and Susan, the control principal, tested it annually.
Right.
If the system was deemed reasonably designed by the firm, and Riley still managed to exploit a tiny flaw to steal the money, can Riley argue in a hearing, hey, the system didn't stop me, the WSPs were flawed, so the firm is at fault, not me?
Absolutely not. A sound supervisory system does not excuse an individual's improper use.
Okay.
The prohibition against stealing or misusing customer property does not depend on the quality of the supervisory system. If Riley steals, Riley is guilty of a violation, regardless of how good or bad the firm's WSPs are.
A good home security system doesn't make burglary legal just because you figured out how to bypass the window alarm.
Precisely. Riley will be barred from the industry for theft. Now, the firm might also be fined for a failure to supervise if their system was genuinely terrible, but Riley cannot use the firm's failure as a shield for his own criminality.
All right, let's move to our final major topic. We are staying with FASH, but we are scaling it up. The $10,000 alarm Large currency transactions.
This is a classic.
Let's bring Sam, the sponsor, back to the front of the stage. Sam loves dealing in actual stacks of physical cash.
Which is an immediate red flag for money laundering, but go on.
Exactly. So what is the strict numerical rule here for large cash drops?
Under the Bank Secrecy Act, financial institutions and broker-dealers absolutely count as financial institutions for this, must file a currency transaction report, or CTR, for each deposit, withdrawal, or exchange of currency of more than $10,000.
Think about the phrasing there. Listen closely.
It's very specific.
Sam walks into the branch and deposits exactly $10,000 in crisp $100 bills.
Mm.
Do we report it under the specific currency rule?
No.
The rule explicitly says more than $10,000. Exactly $10,000 does not cross the threshold.
Correct. It has to be $10,000 and one penny. Well, 1 cent of physical currency. If it hits exactly $10,000, it does not trigger the mandatory CTR filing.
Now let's talk about the history here, because understanding the history helps explain why the rule causes so much friction today. The Bank Secrecy Act was passed in 1970.
Long time ago.
In 1970, $10,000 was a massive amount of physical cash. You could buy a house with that. It caught major drug cartels and organized crime.
Sure.
Today, thanks to 50 years of inflation, $10,000 is a used Honda Civic. But the law hasn't changed, so the threshold catches a lot of totally normal legal commercial activity, which means criminals have to work even harder to avoid the tripwire.
Right. Which leads us to the concept of structuring, or what is commonly called smurfing.
Smurfing. I love that term. Let's pose an absurd hypothetical to show how the aggregation rules catch smurfs. Sam knows the rule is more than $10,000. He has $12,000 in physical cash from his laundromats that he wants to deposit.
Okay, 12 grand total.
He drops off $6,000 in cash at the firm's New York branch at 10 a.m. Then he gets on his private jet, flies across the country, and drops off the remaining $6,000 at the Los Angeles branch at 4 p.m. on the exact same day.
Busy guy.
He never crossed the $10,000 limit at either branch. Is he safe from the report?
Nice try, Sam.
Oh.
But no, the aggregation rules in the BSA are designed exactly to capture this kind of structuring behavior.
Oh, really?
Multiple currency transactions on one business day aggregate into a single reportable transaction if the financial institution has knowledge they are by or on behalf of the same person.
But New York and LA are totally different branches. They are 3,000 miles apart.
It doesn't matter. For this rule, a member firm and all of its domestic branch offices are considered one single financial institution. Two branches do not give the customer two separate limits. The firm's centralized ledger sees it all.
Wow.
So $6,000 in NY plus $6,000 in LA equals a $12,000 day for the firm as a whole. It is more than $10,000. The firm must aggregate it and report it.
Okay, what if Sam plays with the clock instead of the map? He does a weekend drop. He drops $8,000 in the bank's night depository on Saturday night. Then he walks into the lobby on Monday morning and drops another $3,000. Saturday and Monday are different days of the week, right?
They're different days of the week, but they are not different business days. A deposit made at night, over a weekend, or on a holiday counts as received on the next active business day that follows it.
So Saturday's $8,000 physically sits in the vault, but legally it lands on Monday's ledger. Monday's $3,000 also happens on Monday. That's $11,000 on Monday's books. Boom, it crosses the threshold. Report it.
Exactly. The aggregation rules pull that weekend money forward into the next active business day.
And how does the firm actually keep track of all this physical cash moving around internally? Is there a master spreadsheet?
This connects the physical handling of cash back to the firm's strict record-keeping duties. Every single cash receipt or disbursement the firm makes must show up itemized on the firm's daily blotter.
The blotter.
Yeah, the blotter is the record of original entry. It's the raw diary of the firm's daily activities. It must contain an itemized daily record of all receipts and disbursements of cash.
So if a dollar bill touches the firm's hands, it lives forever on the blotter.
Yes. It is the operational consequence of receiving currency. The safeguarding duty, the anti-money laundering reporting duty, and the record-keeping duty all walk hand in hand.
All right. We have covered a massive amount of ground today, from control testing to McLovin passports to taco truck deposits. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways so you can walk into exam day with these concepts locked and loaded. I'll start. We'll trade off.
Let's do it.
Number one, the firm itself holds final supervisory responsibility, not the designated principal who carries out the daily tasks.
Number two, account can only open with a principal's written signature. An undocumented verbal approval at a urinal or anywhere else never counts.
Number 3. Account changes, like an address change to a yacht or a risk objective change, need firm review plus a validation step of confirmation, notification, or follow-up. They are never self-executing.
Number 4. Simply opening an email isn't a review. The required documentation needs the reviewer's name, the item, the date, and, crucially, only if there is a regulatory issue, the action taken.
Number 5. Handing a rep a paper check at a taco truck is a controlled transmittal and requires the same documented validation as a wire transfer.
And number 6. Currency reporting triggers at more than $10,000, and domestic branches aggregate those amounts on the same business day, including weekend rollovers.
Awesome. Now, before we let you go, I want to give you something to chew on, something that connects all of this rigid, paper-based regulation to the future of the industry you are about to enter.
Yeah, think about how every single rule we discussed today was built. They were designed for a physical, tangible world. Paper checks, wet signatures on physical account records, physical branch offices in New York and LA, mailing physical stock certificates through the post office.
It's very old school.
As we move deeper into an era of instant blockchain settlements, decentralized finance, and tokenized assets, the entire concept of a temporary lag in the mail, or the physical possession of a security, is going to fundamentally change.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you define a transmittal when a client can instantly transfer a tokenized bond directly to a rep's digital wallet without a centralized clearing firm ever touching it?
Mind-blowing.
The regulators are going to have to entirely rewrite the underlying architecture of these rules to account for assets that settle in milliseconds on a distributed global ledger rather than sitting for 3 days in a vault.
It's going to be a wild decade for compliance officers, that is for sure. But for today, and more importantly for your Series 82 exam tomorrow, the paper rules still rule the day. The principal still needs to sign the paper, the physical check still needs to be safeguarded, and the x-ray machine of regulatory compliance still relies on human documentation to see the bones of the operation.
Well said. Master the rules of today before you try to write the rules of tomorrow.
Good luck on function 2 of the Series 82. You've got this. Keep studying, keep validating your knowledge, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.